Good afternoon. My name is Will Miller from the Philosophy Department. I'm standing in for Brian Perkins to do introductions this afternoon. And I guess I'd like to perform some of my role as local historian. I came here in 1969 as a new member of the faculty. Michael Parenti, our speaker today, arrived in 1970. After having been a visiting member of the Political Science Department at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. In the spring of 1970, which, to put it in historical context, was the spring of the Kent State and Jackson State massacres, at the height of the anti-war movement in the United States, Michael Parenti, then on the faculty at the University of Illinois, attempted to stop a garbage truck from being backed over a number of students who were engaged in a sit-in at the university at the time. For his efforts, he was assaulted by a member of the local police force in Champaign-Urbana, who was...
Three.
All of whom were wearing riot gear, face masks, shields, helmets. One of them, after... laying Michael's head open with a club, accused him of assaulting, Michael, of having assaulted the police in a kind of Orwellian inversion, having been assaulted by the police, he was then accused of assaulting them, was tried in a notorious kangaroo court proceedings and found guilty of assaulting an officer in that activity. He already had a contract to teach here, so he came to the University of Vermont in the fall of 1970. Before he arrived, the Burlington Free Press and the local media had picked up the stories from Urbana and had already begun to vilify him and condemn him and judge him on insufficient evidence for his activities in Urbana. So even before he arrived on the campus, he was already a celebrity, though not by circumstances of his own choosing. While he was a member of the campus for the 2 years from 1970 to 1972, he brought to the campus his insight into the imperial character of the war in Vietnam and a model of courage to do something about the character of that war. He played a key role in campus-wide teach-ins, in radical student organizing, and he was a model for many of us who were deeply opposed to the war and had not yet moved effectively and in an organized way to counter it. He was at the time one of the best published, one of the most published and best known scholars on the campus, and he was superbly qualified for reappointment at the end of his 2-year contract in 1972. The entire campus community in the review process strongly supported his reappointment, faculty, students, and the administration up to the office of the president. Traditionally, the UVM Board of Trustees had until that time accepted the recommendations of that review process and essentially rubber-stamped them. The trustees played no active role in deciding reappointment and tenure decisions. In Michael's case, however, the precedent was broken. The trustees reached down and overturned the decision of the entire university and decided in a vote of 15-4, a vote taken in this very room, ironically, in December of 1972, 1971, to not renew Michael Parenti. The reasons they gave, since he was eminently qualified by all the standing requirements, publications, teaching, community service, the reasons they gave consisted in inventing something new called professional conduct, which no one had ever heard of before and which Michael had not met in the eyes of the trustees. Let me give you an example of what they call professional conduct. Unprofessional conduct. Michael was invited to be the guest speaker at the Burlington Rotary Club. The Burlington Rotary Club opens its evening events with a pledge of allegiance to the flag. Michael didn't pledge allegiance to the flag and gave a talk instead on how, as long as the line with liberty and justice for all was not true, he would work very hard to make it true, and when it was true, he would be the first to take the pledge. Until such time, it would be hypocritical to do so. The trustees decided not pledging allegiance was unprofessional conduct. Another reason given was carrying a National Liberation Front flag in a demonstration on Church Street in downtown Burlington. The National Liberation Front flag, more commonly known in the press as the Viet Cong flag, was the flag that increasingly, for many of us, had become the flag of the side we should have been on in that war, and not the side we should have been making war against. Michael was carrying a flag that represented the commitments and convictions of a great many of us on and off campus. These and the other reasons they gave were all blatantly unconstitutional. That is, these are cases of politically protected speech and action which they had no basis for firing him for. The trustees gave officially at the time justifications that Michael's anti-business attitudes, anyone with a critique of capitalism is guilty of an anti-business attitude, that Michael's anti-business attitudes were unacceptable to the Board of Trustees. And it was said that he was bad for the image of the university. I take it an image that entails being pro-business, certainly not being critical. The year that Michael was fired, the university handbook was covered with its statement of academic freedom on the front and back covers, as if by publishing that statement they could undo the effects of the firing. The administration, the president, and most of the members of the faculty overwhelmingly agreed that it was a very sad day in the history of the University of Vermont when the trustees were able successfully to remove Parenti's analysis and point of view and voice from this campus. Therefore, it gives me great pleasure, since the intent of the board was to silence Michael and see that he would never speak here again, it gives me great pleasure to thwart their intentions and welcome today's speaker, Professor Michael Parenti.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that introduction. And I know Will gave you that account with a lot of feeling, because he was very involved, Professor Miller was, in the struggle for justice, as a lot of other good people here were. And so they remember it with nostalgia and maybe even with some pain, but also it's good to see that they keep struggling. On the other hand, I wish the hell he hadn't stolen my whole lecture. That's what I was going to talk about. The subject I was going to talk on is monopoly culture and the university. It's my view, of those of you who heard me last night, that, and it's the view of many of us who look at our society, that while we talk about a democratic society, a free and autonomous, pluralistic democratic society, the cultural and social institutions of our society are neither free nor independent nor democratic. They are all run as corporations which are ruled by boards of trustees or regents or directors who are elected by nobody, who are accountable to nobody, with no opposition party or opposition newspaper within their institution, with no power of recall by their constituents. They are run as autocracies, in effect. And these various institutions of law, medicine, art, communication, even religion, in many cases, these institutions reflect the class bias of those who own and control them, or who are the trustees, that is, who are the corporate individuals who have the power over them. These corporate trustees or directors or regents, they can be called different things. In corporations, they're called directors almost always. They have the final say. They pick the president. They pick the top officers. They have final and absolute say over all matters of budget. In the university, the Board of Trustees has final say over all matters of curriculum. They could abolish a particular course if they want, and they do that. They may even reach down. Generally, they leave that stuff up to chairman and up to the deans. They could even abolish a position or a professor if they want, as was just described. Generally, in normal times, they leave those decisions up to their administrators. That's why they hire these administrators. But if something goes wrong, if the administrator turns around and says, there is such a thing as freedom, justice, and academic freedom, then they do rein back in the power that they have lent out to the deans and the presidents and vice presidents and provosts and chairmen of departments. They rein that power back in, and they come down in any way they want, calling upon the corporate power that they have through the state. They are chartered through the state, and they have the power of the state to back their decisions. While they are private, independent institutions, they are publicly chartered by law, which means that they can call in the police that they can call in the courts, that the law is written on their side. And this begins to clear up a mystery. Why in all those years when the students would sit in and say this university is going the wrong way, why was it when the students said the university is violating its charter, the university is playing with the CIA, the university is acting complicitly with the war in Vietnam, the university trustees have conflicts of interests, why is it the students couldn't call in the police to get rid of the trustees, but the trustees could call in the police to get rid of the students? Why was that? Here was a dispute between two private groups in a private institution in our pluralistic society, but state power came in consistently on the side of one of those groups. It was the group that owned the property. It was the protection of a class property interest against a clientele or a constituency that might make counterclaims against that class power. It was a class institution, even as it maintained that it was not a class institution, and even as it fired those professors who said it was a class institution and fired them for saying that. It operated like a class institution nevertheless. And if you look at the institutions, the cultural and social institutions of this free, independent, democratic society, you find that pattern again and again. Those trustees decide all matters of curriculum. They decide whether there's going to be a sociology and anthropology department. The trustees that year they fired me voted on whether or not the Department of Sociology and Anthropology should become two separate departments. They voted. And I looked over the roster of state legislators, who themselves are usually real estate speculators and big restaurant owners and such, and private businessmen, some of whom are vice presidents of General Motors, whose job I understand is to produce mediocre cars that can't compete with the Japanese. And these men loomed as the experts, the intellectual leaders of our UVM community. And they decided, yes, we'll have a separate Department of Anthropology and Sociology. A decision that must have cost, what, maybe another $20,000 in terms of a secretary, an extra stationery, another office in those days. That had to go to the Board of Trustees to be decided, and they had the power of deciding. They can decide everything. They can decide the name of your hockey team, if they want to, or the name of your football team. And that happened. I'm not making that up. I mean, they can decide it, and there was an actual case. At the University of Stanford in 1970, the students voted in recognition of the fact that the founder, Leland Stanford, how he made his millions of dollars, they voted to name their football team the Robber Barons. And the trustees hit the ceiling, of course, the Robber Barons. And they, after a referendum and an election of a bunch of names, the students voted overwhelming, their football team called the Robber Barons. The trustees said, no, you do not even have the power to name your football team if you pick a name that we don't like. You have the power if you do what you're supposed to do. And so they overruled it, and the trustees named the team the Cardinals. And so if you look at various other of our institutions, you find the same kind of thing. You look at law, and you find that in most law schools, you learn law from the perspective of the corporation, not from the perspective of the consumer. There's no great body of consumer law. There may be a course here or there. But you generally, the hot subjects are corporate law, tax law, investment law, that sort of stuff, torts. You learn the law from the perspective of the landlord and the real estate developers, not from the perspective of the homeowner or the tenants. You learn the law from the perspective of a government agency, a city agency, not from the perspective of the welfare mother. When you go into medicine, you also find that medicine has very little to do with healing the sick, with social service. Medicine is primarily a business. And you learn a whole vocabulary to disguise that business. You have a business, but you call it a practice. You have customers, but you call them patients. And you charge them prices, but you call that fees. And you market a service, but you call it medicine. And what's happened, of course, with medicine is that the plundering got so bad with what with medical care and public funding that we publicly funded, we took public resources and channelized them not into a public nonprofit service with a good and ample salary to the doctor, which he should get, but we instead channelized it right into this private business. We took the public money and gave it to the private business. Therefore, it became in the interest of the private business to sell you as much service as they could. There was a limitation before. The limitation was your pocketbook. But now that you have publicly funded insurance, I will run tests through, $300, $400, $500 worth of tests, even if you may not need it. I'll put you up in a hospital because I'm a shareholder in that hospital, and we'll charge you, $200 a night for your stay. And you go on like this. And what happened through the 1970s on into the early 80s is that with all the years of recession and all, while corporate profits were going like this, wobbly and all that, and growth was you know, slumped to 1%, 2%, even a few negative years of growth, 80, 81, 82, the medical industry was going like this in terms of its growth and its profits, to the point where the medical capitalists were cutting into the profits of the non-medical capitalists. So that a corporation like General Electric would complain that one of their biggest single budget items was the insurance costs for their employees. And it was getting so bad that the rest of the capitalist class decided that the doctors were ripping off too much, and they've gotten the laws changed. There's now a move toward what is called cost treatment, I think it is. So now you, instead of before, let's say if you had pneumonia, I'm the doctor, I bring you in, you stay for 3 weeks, I'll give you every test imaginable, give you all sorts of medicines, maybe even treatments and things you don't need, but I, out of that, I clean up $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 out of you, let's say, in those weeks. Not out of you, out of the public insurance program. Now the government says, no, if someone's got pneumonia, that's going to be a limit of $2,000. Now the profit motive operates the other way, which is I will make as much profit not by piling services onto you, but by giving you as little as possible. If I get $2,000 for a pneumonia patient, it's better that I give you $1,000 worth of service and I make $1,000 profit. So now what you're having is people being sent home who aren't fully recovered, people being sent home without adequate diagnoses and so forth and so on, so that the boys can clean up. So that's how the profit motive works. Whether the money is coming in or the money is tightening up, if it comes in, it's being plundered. If it tightens up, then we get the cost of that. That's because medicine in this country is organized as a business. This is, by the way, not necessarily a reflection on individual doctors. There can be doctors who are very dedicated people who try to do decent by their patients and all that, but who are working in a system that is organized that way and who eventually have to charge those kind of fees, who eventually have to worry about that sort of thing, who have their malpractice insurance, blah, blah, all these other kinds of things. And as private entrepreneurs, they begin to act like private entrepreneurs. You are what you do, as Marx said, regardless of what your intentions might sometimes be. Then take even an area like art. Now, what could be more detached from politics than art? Well, art shouldn't be and isn't really detached from politics. But one of the affectations, one of the ideologies taught in art schools and taught in art magazines, most of which are funded by the very rich, is that art is something above politics. Art is something separate from politics. When I was at the University of Illinois during the Kent State uprisings and the time I got beaten up by the police, there was three or four police clubbing me. They were in there windmilling me. My head was covered with blood and it was an incredible situation in that there were students screaming and rioting, and they dragged me into this police car and started stoning the car. It said police on, except I was in it, you know, and And they surrounded the campus police jail so they couldn't get me to the hospital. They finally sneaked me out the back door and got me into the hospital. If there are people who want to come in, why don't you just let them in? There's sort of space around here, seats here if you want. There was an artist there, a very prominent artist. Well, he was the son of a very famous American artist, Ben Shawn, famous artist during the Depression. Sam remembers him, and some of us artists know his work. It was very, very famous stuff. It was Ben Shawn's son, Jonathan Shawn, who was an artist. Jonathan Shawn was so horrified and moved by what he saw happen to me that he did a woodcut of it. Picture of, you know, me lying there in the street like that. I don't know. It was totally inaccurate, but I mean, it was a very moving thing. And then we did prints on the woodcut, and we sold them, and we raised money for the Vietnam anti-war movement and all that stuff. And I saw Jonathan, and I said, "That was really wonderful of you to do that. Isn't it great that you could apply your art as a weapon in the struggle here?" And he said, "Oh no, that's not my art. That's propaganda. I mean, I was doing that." So Jonathan had been so brave. His father would have been ashamed of him because his father did not make that distinction. His father's art was very political. He worked with the Writers and Artists Projects and did things during the Depression and all that. Jonathan saw that art is something that's really quite removed and above politics, you see, and separate from politics. And that when it gets into politics, then it's socialist realism or it's propaganda or it's tainted in some way. In fact, the depoliticization of art was itself a very real political movement. And there are a couple of books out on this, and I had the reprints of stuff, and I wanted to cite things, but take my word for it. Norman Goldberg is one guy who's written on this, on how much of art has been... how many of the art schools and artists who did realistic work were simply not shown. How non-objective, abstract art was encouraged by the Rockefellers, the Morgans, and the Mellons. Who do you think owns the art world? Who do you think buys the art? It's the Mellons, the Morgans, the Rockefellers, and the DuPonts, and the Hartfords, and the Lees, and various others. Art is an area of investment for them. The museum you got in New York is called the Huntington Hartford Museum, isn't it? It's not too many. Art is something that the rich buy and then put into the museums they build, which they get enormous tax write-offs and which are sources of investment and value appreciation. Someone open another window. I'm just really kind of warm. Are you all warm too, or is this just me with this subject? Artists who are political do not get shown often. I'm talking about the mainstream big East Side galleries. Although that can change. Ralph Facinella painted in the obscurity and in the... he painted in... Don't freeze this out completely, but... for years, and he worked as a gas station attendant. He couldn't get jobs. He was red-baited out of his labor union. And finally, there was a showing of his work, and now his canvases go for $25,000. It's very political, because there was a public for it, and he got a breakthrough in New York Magazine and was shown at one gallery, and to everybody's astonishment, literally tens of thousands of people showed up, and suddenly Facinella's magnificent canvases of street scenes and demonstrations and political meetings and all that sort of thing. Magnificent things done very crudely. You can see a self-taught artist, but with a real something in it. Now he's a famous artist. But that exception, I think, demonstrates the rule of what generally happens. It doesn't mean that art cannot also be used as a political weapon, which it can be. Take another example of religion. The history of religion as being an instrument of the owning class in this and almost every other society is so well established, so well documented, that one need not dwell on that too much. In almost every country, the religious leaders are aligned with the business leaders. The cardinals, with some few dramatic exceptions, do not sit with the poor. They dine with the rich. They do not live in huts. They live in palaces. And so it is with most of the churches. The Protestant evangelical churches, some of them, not all of them, are being conscientiously used now in places like Honduras and Salvador to preach an anti-communist, right-wing status quo line, to tell you not to struggle in this world, but to wait for the blessings of the next. To agitate against the powers that be is to propagate a godless communism. That's the line. I'm going to say something else about religion now. And that is that, and again, in all these cultural institutions, there's something else that's also going on at the same time. There are lawyers who decide not to work for the corporations, but to work for the poor, who become Ralph Nader-type lawyers or public interest group lawyers or William Kunstlers, who live on less but do more. There are doctors who decide not to serve the rich but to heal the sick, not to become self-enriching but to heal the sick. And there are artists who do use their art in whatever limited areas and limited opportunities they can for the purposes of liberation, for the purposes of reaching into real human and social issues. And there are religious people who move and take the word of God to mean not to sup with the rich and powerful, but to actually live with the poor and humble and to become purveyors of a liberation theology, as you know. In fact, the church has become an instrument, a social force in countries like Guatemala, Nicaragua, where the church in Nicaragua is split right down the middle, with the upper clergy siding with the Contras and the Reaganites and the counter-revolution, and the lower clergy siding with the mass of the campesinos and people and workers. In the Philippines, where you've got a great cardinal with a great name, Cardinal Sin, so I think it's there's a venial sin and cardinal sin, we always know. And where the church, again, operated as a real instrument for democratic forces, and still operates that way for democratic forces in that society, if not necessarily for revolutionary forces, but certainly democratic forces, including Mrs. Aquino, who comes from a Catholic background, who's also very rich, but who may turn out to have a few surprises before the CIA is through with her. Now, if you look at the university, the history of the university has been a history of purges and suppression of deviancy, but also a struggle for dissidents and a struggle for democratic thought. The universities, for instance, E.A. Ross, an eminent, great American sociologist, was one of the earliest who was purged, kicked out of Stanford University by Mrs. Stanford, who didn't like the nice words he had to say about Eugene Victor Debs, Bernie Sanders' hero, who was a socialist and a great American labor leader and a great American socialist who was running for the presidency at the time. E.A. Ross, despite the fact that he had tenure, was kicked out of Stanford University. Thorsten Veblen, probably the greatest economist and sociologist the United States has ever produced, was kicked out of a number of schools because of his critical class analysis. Scott Nearing, our own Vermonter, was kicked out, I think it was when, about 1920 or so, and never got another university job for the next 70 years of his life. He lived to be 95. In fact, when I was fired here from UVM, and the thing was a big flap in the papers and all that, I went to my office one day and there was a book, you know, mailed to me, and I opened it up and it was called The Making of a Radical by Scott Nearing, with a personal inscription from him and all that. And it was very nice, and I read the book, and it's remarkable. Plus ça change, plus la même chose. You know, I mean, 50 years later, and it was, more than 50 years later, and his story sounded so remarkably similar, the kind of things the trustees were saying, and the kind of rationalizations they were making, and the uproar caused, and all that sort of thing. There were more political firings on the university campuses of America in the 1970s than there were during the McCarthyite period of the 1950s. And when you always hear about McCarthyism, bum, 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 remember that it still gets practiced. And that was true certainly at this university. I was fired, two-thirds of the philosophy department was fired, Will Miller lost four or five of his colleagues. And various others, I don't remember half the cases, but every time I come back for a visit, we say, we got another one.
Alex Novikov.
Alex Novikov, that was much earlier, wasn't that before me?
It was before you.
And then the guy who died of a heart attack, the English teacher.
Ralph Underhill in sociology.
Ralph Underhill in sociology. Every few years they'd ask me back to talk because there would be another incident. I mean, I'd always loved coming back to UVM, but it was terrible to come back under those circumstances. But there was another case. And UVM was not the exception. At Dartmouth College, back in the early 70s, there was a group of pacifist, anti-war, radical professors that used to meet, I think, once every 2 weeks for lunch, 12 of them. Within 2 years, they were all gone out of the university. The University of Illinois, when I was there, the four leading radical professors were all fired. Phil Maranto, John Lombardi, the third one, it slips my mind right now. I was the fourth. When I got there as a visiting professor, they were coming along and saying, would you like to stay? Would you like to stay? Following me around with a contract and a wet pen, would I want to sign? I said, well, you know, I might, but my son is in the East. I'll be too far away from him. And they said, but yeah, I know. And then when they noticed that I was getting up at these anti-war rallies and talking and doing this and agitating, that was the end of it. There were no more people asking me, do I want to stay? I couldn't get the right time of day after that. So at the end of that year, I was let go. I've been kicked out of some of the best universities in America. In the political science department of the University of Washington in Seattle, every single person who had a dissident viewpoint was fired, with the exception of Maranto, because he had tenure. By mistake, they'd given him tenure, and he finally just left. He got so disgusted. The entire criminology school at Berkeley, the entire school of criminology was abolished because they began to study criminology from a class perspective, because they no longer studied it as a problem of law enforcement and control only. They began developing new perspectives which were becoming very uncomfortable for those who see criminology as a weapon of class control. The entire school was abolished, with the exception of the few teachers in that school who took an orthodox view. They were then taken out and they were plugged into traditional departments that existed, like sociology. But all the other people who had tenure and everything else, you can get rid of tenure people, call it budgetary exigency. And you say, and you just eliminate the budget, and they were all wiped out. One of my favorite cases was the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, Ted Hayes, a political scientist. Ted Hayes wasn't renewed, and the men in his department, the senior members in his department, said that we're not renewing you because you're a radical, and therefore you cannot be objective in the classroom. Being a radical, you have outside political attachments which will mar your scholarly approach. Three of those four people on that committee happened to be Republican state committeemen themselves. But that was okay. That does not mar your perspective, you see, as long as you're a Republican or mainstream in that way. Just 4 years ago, the Virginia Commonwealth University, the political science department of Virginia Commonwealth University, invited me down to be interviewed to be chairman of their department. Rather late in the year, the guy they thought they were going to have as chairman turned down the job. And I got the story, they didn't even want to invite me, and one of the members insisted and said, well, let's just take a look at him. No, this guy's a troublemaker. But they decided to invite me down. Some of them were just curious to see, what's he like, you know? So I went down, spent a whole day, met the members of the department, and even had a meeting. We met around the table and all that, and we had a discussion about policies and all that. They said, how would you run the department? I said, I'd run just the way I'm running it now. And they liked that because, you know, I don't like to run anything. I don't like to have power over anybody. The most empowering and energizing thing to me is seeing people act as their own active social agents. And we operate together and we think together. We can have conflicts and all that, but I don't want to sit there like, you know, the capo over some little gang here or something. You do what I say, you know. So the department voted unanimously to have me be the chairman of the Department of Political Sciences at Virginia Commonwealth University. I'm not even sure Will knows this story, but anyway, And the dean voted for it. And then I met with the committee of the chairman of all the different departments. And they voted for me. Said, yeah, he'd be a good chairman. It's great. And all that. And then a new dean came in during this process. And she said, and she gathered the political science department together, and being new, she was utterly candid, which was a mistake. And she said, we can't have a radical as chairman of the department. And the department is all aghast. She was saying, there is a political test. There is an ideological control. And if you are a certain place in the political spectrum, you cannot work here. And that's it. She said it was all right to have an instructor as a radical instructor, but not a radical chairman. See, that's stupid. You shouldn't say, you should say, yeah, well, he's very good and all that, but he doesn't have enough administrative experience. And you can kind of muffle it up and say, he's really not what we had in mind for the development of this and that. So another technique that's often used is saying, well, is he the very best person we can get? My friend Lombardi was denied tenure at University of Illinois because the chairman said he was a chemist, and but very active in the anti-war movement. Said, are you the best spectroscopist in the world or in America? Spectroscopy is a form of chemistry that uses laser and all that. He happens to be, by the way, one of the very best. The Chinese invite him to Peking University to study laser stuff and all that, and they sit at his feet. The guy is brilliant, utterly brilliant. And Lombardi said, I don't know who would be the best spectroscopist. I don't know how you could define that. And they said, well, we're not certain that you're the very best, so we're going to fire you. And he had a string of, publications. His chairman, who was a right-winger and a hawk on the war, and saw the commies at the gates of University of Illinois every evening, banging at the gates, fired him because of his political views. Bertell Ohman was denied his appointment at the University of Maryland under the same guise. The department voted him in as chairman of the University of Maryland, and the argument that went up to President Hall was, is Ohman the very best political theorist we could get for this position? Because, right, the very best from all over the world, from the Sorbonne, from Cambridge, and all, they all want to go to the University of Maryland, right? Ohman, who had published about 5 books and whatever else. So. Well, it is argued, as it did in the instance of Ted Hayes, that political advocacy mars your capacity as a teacher. I kept running into that at UVM. I had reporters from the local TV stations, Mickey Gallagher's boys, come over and say, don't you think, though, if you're committed to something, that this would mar your objectivity? We reporters, for instance, we do not get too involved in political things. Up to their ears in politics, of course. Their publishers and their producers and their station owners and the managers and all these people, they go and wine and dine. You look at a White House list. I look at one with some visiting dignitary. It was the Duke and Duchess of Luxembourg came to for a White House dinner, state dinner. And I look down the list, and there's the usual lists of politicians and top cabinet members and celebrities. And then you see Zimmerman, publisher of U.S. News and World Report, Ted Koppel and his wife from Nightline, George Will and his wife from ABC. Come, and you start looking at all these media people who are there dining with power, protecting their objectivity and distance and neutrality at the White House. It's not the absence of involvement. You can be involved. You just got to be involved in the right politics. Henry Kissinger wasn't detached. Henry Kissinger wrote political books and he served political masters. He was Nelson Rockefeller's toady. He wrote for Nelson Rockefeller. And when Henry Kissinger left Harvard to become national security advisor for Richard Nixon, Nelson Rockefeller gave him $50,000 as a going away gift, reminding Henry who he really belonged to. And Nelson Rockefeller, I'm quoting Nelson Rockefeller, he admitted in his Senate confirmation hearings when he was appointed Vice President of the United States after Ford was appointed President after Nixon and Agnew were kicked out, and Rockefeller was made Vice President of the United States, he said, I gave $50,000 to Henry Kissinger. And the Senator said, Those senators were really hard on him. They said, whoa, Mr. Rockefeller, why did you do that? And he said, because giving has always been a tradition of the Rockefeller family. And none of those senators fell off their chair laughing or anything like that. And that's the answer. Give and ye shall receive. Give and ye shall make billions, it seems. And Ziggy Brzezinski, what was the political neutrality and detachment and scholarly remove and aloofness of Ziggy Brzezinski, who you can't sit with for half an hour without him hinting how he works for the CIA and how he's talked to Casey and this CIA guy and that CIA guy, and he stands there and machos his CIA, flashes his CIA stuff, who was also National Security Advisor under Jimmy Carter. These guys are into politics up to their ears. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan. What was he? Paul Moynihan was a classic case. He did what they always do. You go out and you get yourself a choice university and you write the kind of things that attract the powers that be, and then you look east. You look east for an appointment to Harvard, Yale, or Princeton. And then when you get there, you head yourself an institute and you write to the choice establishment things like foreign policy and say, how we got to do this and do that. Wouldn't this be great? We've got to be tougher here and all that. And then you look south to Washington. And then you get the call to Washington, you see, and you become an ambassador, or become an advisor, you become this and all that, and then you are there into politics. And that's what Daniel Patrick Moynihan did. He served power, he sucked up to power, and he did it all his life. And the careers of Kissinger and Brzezinski and Moynihan were meteoric. They zoomed up. And they were totally, absolutely political, absolutely partisan. So it's not scholarly detachment, it's not political involvement, it's if you're involved in the wrong kind of politics, if you're involved in those kind of politics which demystify the existing social relations of this society, which say, no, we do not have neutral institutions. We have institutions that are riddled with political interests, and those interests have class biases all through them. Having said all this, I would remind you yet again of the priests in the villages in Guatemala and El Salvador. And I would remind you that along with my firing, there were scores of faculty, thousands of students who fought back. In fact, to such an extent that for the first time I started getting decent media coverage. Do you remember when Robert Strunk was here? He wrote for that rag, what was the...
The Vermont Sunday News,
is that still in existence?
No.
Oh, good. I outlived the Vermont Sunday News. And, Strunk wrote his first honest news story. It was a right-wing newspaper, which was owned and published by the New Hampshire faction.
William Loeb.
Nobody knows William Loeb. He died.
He died.
That's a shame. Mine enemies grow older. And as my colleagues say, I never get old, right, guys? the first honest column he wrote about me was the day of the Board of Trustees voting me down, because he sat in that room and he heard 35 different people get up, colleagues of mine, students, all sorts of people get up and talk about how my contract should be renewed, that justice dictated it, that academic freedom dictated it, that the students had a right to hear another point of view, that the trustees had no right to be political police. And that, suddenly he saw the impact of democratic forces operating, and it actually swayed the kind of story he wrote. And that began to happen. So you see, along with class oppression, there is fight back and class struggle. Along with a pope who sits with power and pomp, and a Cold War anti-communist pope, you also have these priests doing these things. And so you get, in all these cultural institutions, some contradiction. For that cultural institution, as I said before, to legitimate itself and control, it has to give lip service to certain ideals. For the university to hide the fact that it is a corporation with a class interest that turns out a class product with an ideological control system within it, it also has to say it's an arena of free investigation and analysis. And for many of the professors who never go beyond a certain line, it is always that. For those whose research never hits the parameters of that might offend these rulers, they do not have a sensation of repression. For those students who never vote for a team without calling it the Tigers or the Bears or the Buffaloes, and who don't ever call it the Robber Barons, they will never be censored. So there is a feeling of freedom. At the same time, I lost my train of thought. I interrupted that with something else. The point I wanted to make. When I come next time, I'll probably have it here. At the same time, along with the repression, you do have fight back. Along with the conformity, you do have people who are dissidents. And the legitimating ideology, which says that we are free, then becomes a problem. Because that's the point I wanted to make. Because if you have this legitimating ideology, which says we live in a free academic community, and people have that sensation of freedom, then they will expect to be free. Then they will begin to question and challenge the arbitrary, unaccountable power of a board of trustees. If you say you're free to investigate, the wonderful thing about being an American is to be able to hear different points of view, then people will demand the right to hear different points of view, so that you can sometimes hoist them on their own petard. So that the legitimating cloak, which makes the use of power easier, also is a problem. And so concessions sometimes do have to be made. After getting rid of me and seeing what an uproar that was, and seeing those same forces mobilized behind Will Miller, they gave Will Miller tenure, which was about the last thing they wanted to do. And it was the last thing they ever did for him. So victories can be won even within those institutions. In other words, there is within that institution a dual element. There is the possibility of fighting back. The legitimating ideology becomes a vulnerability. You can use it and turn it right back on them. That dual ideology, that legitimating ideology in the church is a very clear one. When you have the spectacle of an anti-communist, a Cold War right-wing pope running all around the globe, pulling his priests away from the struggles of the oppressions of the poor and censoring them and silencing them when they talk about liberation theology, and then himself making pronouncements about the poor and how the poor should be helped and how the rich should not be too greedy and that sort of thing. So that there's a constant need to maintain a certain appearance. To maintain that appearance, there's often a need to make concessions. There have been democratic victories won in this society. There have been democratic victories won in our history. We don't have children working 14 hours a day in factories anymore for a dollar a day. Women do have the vote. Working people, even ordinary working people, have the vote, even if they don't have property. We do have a thing like Social Security. We do have a thing like unemployment insurance and disability insurance. All of these things are totally inadequate. The vote is not an adequate instrument of our protection. It's not an adequate weapon against class rule. The Social Security isn't adequate in your old age. The unemployment compensation won't be adequate and all that. But these are real victories. What Reagan has shown us is that none of these democratic victories are secure under capitalism. That at any time, if capitalism wants to shift its austerity down upon the shoulders of ordinary working people and middle class and the poor, it will do so. At any time when it mobilizes itself, it will fight back and it will cut back and cut into those human services and democratic victories that the people have won. At any time, job securities may be lost. At any time, the freedoms we've won can be circumscribed. The Freedom of Information Act, the exposures that were won there, the calling to accountable, unaccountable power, the reining in of the CIA, all of that were real victories. There were real victories won in the 60s and the 70s. When Ford and Kissinger stood there and wanted to go into Angola with 20 Marine and Army divisions, they couldn't do it. That was because of the years of struggle of the peace movement in this society. Today, the victory in saving the lives of people in Nicaragua. Do you realize that the United States has not invaded Nicaragua? Do you realize what that means? Do you realize that the United States has invaded Nicaragua 11 times in the last 80 or 90 years and has occupied Nicaragua 3 times for periods of as much as 10 years, occupied and controlled it? And that today the destructive forces, the deployment forces, the striking power, the firepower of this country is about 1,000 times heavier and more destructive than it was when Calvin Coolidge sent the Marines down there to kill Sandinista, and that guy in the White House is more determined, more eager, and more hungry to attack Nicaragua than any of the other presidents, more so than Coolidge, more so than Woodrow Wilson, more so than any of them, and yet he doesn't. There's only one thing that's stopping him, and that's the democratic forces of this society, world opinion, democratic forces around the world, and the determination of the Nicaraguan people. It wouldn't be just a few small bands of Sandino's men. There's a whole society there. And it would mean unacceptable losses to the Americans. They could go in. Our forces could go, not our forces, Reagan's forces could go in and could take that country. But they would have unacceptable losses. What makes those losses unacceptable? They're not unacceptable to Ronald Reagan. He lost 261 Marines blown away in one day in Lebanon. That's not why he took that expeditionary force out. He wants U.S. forces in Lebanon. He knows what he was doing. He does not want a revolutionary or reformist or social democratic government in Lebanon that blocks off yet another area from the multinationals. It's another social revolutionary change. His class doesn't want that. He didn't take the Marines out because he was worried about the dead bodies. He's got plenty more. He's got fodder right in this room, and he'll have you register for that. He took them out because American public opinion was on his back and said, you get them out of there. And that's why he pulled them out. It was politically too costly. So we have power, ladies and gentlemen. Don't forget that. Whatever those institutions, however undemocratic, however controlled they are, however powerful they seem, we have power too. Let me tell you what happened just 4 years ago. 4 years ago, I was invited by a small, ragged band of Filipinos to talk at a demonstration at Lafayette Park in front of the White House. Talk at the White House. We had these amplifier phones. I tell my friends, I'm talking at the White House tonight. And I've done a lot. I lived in Washington the last 6 years, and I've done a lot of talking at the White House. Always from across the street at Lafayette Park with these big bullhorns and all that. So I talked at the White House, and I gave the big keynote thing, and there was 200 of our people, about half Filipino and half American, with the placards and all that, and I'm saying the truth about the Philippines, that it's not a poor country, that it's a rich country. It's filled with riches and resources. And enormous wealth is created there. Only the people are poor. The people are poor. But there's a lot of wealth in the Philippines. And you ask Chase Manhattan, and you ask Texaco, and you ask Firestone, you ask all those people, Pillsbury, Procter & Gamble, all people got down there using slave labor in the Philippines. You ask them if it's a poor country, they're making big bucks in the Philippines. You ask Ferdinand Marcos, is the Philippines a poor country? And he'll tell you, rich, rich, a lot of money there. And I gave this whole talk, and I'm looking over, and I'm saying, and something in me is doing what happens to all of us, right? Something in me is bleeding. Because what we have is our band of 200 people walking around the park there, and across the street is about 500 police with their riot guns and their clubs and their gear and their cars and their motorcycles and their woo 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 and their lights and all this, and all this power and force. And there we are walking like a tattered little band. And up comes this great fleet of limousines, because Ferdinand Marcos is arriving at the White House to be hugged and kissed by his massa, Ronald Reagan. And so Ferdinand and Ronnie are hugging on the front porch of the White House, and there are all those limousines, and there's the press corps, and there's all the cameras pointing that way, and none of the cameras are at us, so we can reach the American people with another side of the story. And there we are, and they say, what's going on? You know, I mean, it's so, look at all the power they got. Look how powerless we are. And we have a big display on the gate there in the Lafayette Park, and it's pictures. We have photos of Filipinos who were tortured to death, were assassinated. Grisly, ghoulish, horrible photos of people lying on the sides of roads, or people with their sides of their face blown up like corpses, blown up like that. And all around the place are Filipino honchos, heavies, Marcos' secret police. The guys are sitting there, and they're checking out the Filipinos. If they recognize anybody, anybody who's a relative of anybody else. And they're looking. And one of them comes walking over, as I come over after I finish talking, and I'm looking at these pictures, and he comes walking over to the pictures, and he looks at the pictures, and he goes, and he starts to smirk. and laughing like it was funny. And I never had such a feeling that I wanted to whoop somebody upside, you know, just really, just give him one right on the side of his head. But I've outgrown those years, and so I didn't do it. Not to mention the guy was probably carrying a 38 or something, I don't know. But you know, I really had the feeling, but I had this feeling of powerlessness. And yet it's a funny thing, you know, you speak truth to power and you fight back. And 4 years later, where is Marcos now? And where are his tin soldiers? They're scurrying like rats and roaches. And the Tonton Macoute in Haiti that went around arbitrarily stopping sometimes in place and shooting a waitress. There was an account in the New York Times. The reporter came in and said, "Where's my favorite waitress?" And the guy said, "The terrible thing happened, monsieur. She walked outside, some Tonton Macoute came by and said, 'Look at the pretty girl,' and they blew her away and they just shot her dead, laughed and rode off." The Tonton Macoute are now being hunted like the rats they are, and they're being strung up. It's a very funny thing about power, you know? It's a very funny thing. We must continue to organize and fight back, to speak truth to power, and feel your power grow. You know, in the raucous history, the trickle, quiet trickles turn into a tide. Until one day the soldiers look the other way or they melt into the crowd drawn by the pounding of a million footsteps. And we stand there and we speak truth to power. And stand there like a thousand legions and speak truth to power and see your power grow. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Can you tell me how come there aren't any universities?
Why are there no university faculty or administrators on the board of trustees? Isn't the president on the board of trustees? Do you have a vote? Is he ex officio? Yeah, just the president is on the board of trustees. And there are two student trustees, aren't they? And they have a vote. They voted the right way on divestment, I'm told. Yeah, Sam.
If they're not your representative, then the House of Representatives this year introduced a bill that would allow to reorganize the board of trustees in the month to get rid of the nine self-perpetuating trustees and to have them replaced by representatives from the student body, from the faculty and other constituent groups.
Great. We've been wanting to have that kind of bill for a long time. The answer to your question is my whole lecture. The reason there are no rank and file trustees, or very few, is because the trustees are an instrument of corporate class control. And if you break that power, by the way, they weren't always. The trustees of most universities were clergymen back in the 1800s. When the product you turned out were mostly clergymen or divinity students or something like that. When the university started becoming a function of corporate capitalist America, that's when the leaders of business moved in with, as they moved into all other areas, they became senators and they became community and church leaders and all that sort of thing. And so that's why you got that situation. Yeah.
I have to remind you of an amusing irony, and that is...
Could you stand up, Sam? Sam Bogart, an eminent professor who's now... I managed to bring out of retirement to come hear this lecture. I mean, that's good. Yeah.
Alex Novikov, who was a professor in the medical school, and who was fired because he refused to testify before the House Un-American Affairs Committee back in the late 40s, early 50s, brought back to the university 2 years ago and given an honorary degree. I'm glad to see that you've maintained your health so well since you've been gone. You may live long enough to be brought back for similar honors.
I'd have to live long enough to... I'd have to live as long as Scott Nearing did.
Hold my breath while you were away.
That's right. Well, I last thing I do is hold my breath. That's why they fired me. I wouldn't hold my breath. This question of democratic fightback, I think, should really be emphasized. You could see, for instance, how Ronald Reagan has had to make concessions and do things which he has not wanted to do. For instance, when Reagan came into office, he said, "We will not negotiate with the Russians." I mean, he was emphatic. He's been saying that for 20 years. There's no negotiating with him. There's nothing to negotiate. They're evil, they're this, they're that. That was the line he took. That line proved to be politically too costly. Within 2 years, you had this massive nuclear freeze movement all over the country, sweeping the country, across the whole political spectrum. And you had peace demonstrations all in Western Europe, whenever else. Then Reagan moved into stage two, which was, that was about, say, 82, 83. We'll negotiate, but don't expect anything out of it. Nothing's going to come out of it. And he was right. He sent his ministers to Geneva, and the Soviets said, let's negotiate the Kruz and Pershing missiles. You are putting missiles in Western Europe, which will have an 8-minute strike force, which is the end of deterrence, which is a first strike capacity, you see. If it takes my missiles a half hour to get to you, to kill you, you have a half hour to detect that my missiles are coming, which you can do what? Set your missiles off against me. My awareness that you can detect my missiles striking you is a deterrence from me attempting a first strike. If, however, I can reduce my strike down to 8 or 7 minutes by putting Kruz and Pershing low-flying missiles in West Germany and Holland, wherever they are, in Belgium, Italy, England, and reduce my strike time to 7 minutes, in fact, going under your radar so you only detect these missiles in the last 2 minutes, you no longer have a retaliatory deterrence. I can no longer threaten you not to use your first strike instrument by firing back. I won't know until I'm hit that you've launched your missiles. And this is why the Soviets were beside themselves about the Kruz and Pershing missiles. And they said, if we're going to negotiate in Geneva, let's negotiate these destabilizing missiles. And Gorbachev still wants to negotiate those missiles. And he's willing to get rid of his SS-20s, which are intermediate range missiles. But the difference is his SS-20s, which are nasty little weapons, cannot reach the United States. They are not strategic. They do not have a first strike capacity. They can hit England or France and such. But the U.S. Kruz and Pershings can hit the Soviet Union and can knock out their missiles. So it's part of the whole first strike arsenal, as is the Star Wars. Now the Soviets are coming around and saying, we will dismantle all our SS-20s if you get rid of all your intermediate and all your forward attack missiles. And if you give us two other guarantees, one, that the English and French will stop building their missiles and building up, and two, that you will not transfer any of your existing missiles in Europe to the English and French, which are two reasonable guarantees. And the Reagan administration is refusing to negotiate and refusing to recognize those two guarantees in its counteroffer. But right there, you see, they have been willing to negotiate. Now, he sat down in 83 in Geneva, and he said, Kruz and Pershing is not negotiable. And so the Soviets walked out, and he turned to the American people and said, we tried to negotiate, but they walked out. Then he went to stage three, because that wasn't really selling too well. And stage three was, we fervently hope that we will achieve peace. And all the sycophantic columnists were saying, President Reagan is now having his rendezvous with history. He really now believes this is going to happen. And they just wimp and kiss him and try to see the positive side and help him along there. And the guy just uses them, you know. And stage three is, we are definitely going to meet with a Soviet leader and we're going to try and reach an understanding. And he met in Geneva and nothing was put on the table. And the Soviets said the same thing. We want to negotiate, and Gorbachev will come to the U.S. He said, but is this a charade or is something going to be put on the table? And I'm writing an open letter to Mikhail Gorbachev and say, come to the U.S. Be used by President Reagan. Because in the act of doing that, nevertheless, you defuse his image of the evil empire. You see? And that's what the Reaganites are caught in. They have to now do what I was talking about, this two-edged sword of legitimation and credibility. To maintain their credibility, they have to show the American people that they're interested in peace. To do that, they have to go through the motions. But once they start going through the motions, there's an expectation of peace. They reveal something about the Soviets which contradicts the image that they have been propagating, which is that Gorbachev is very much interested in a negotiated settlement. That he very much would like to dismantle that nuclear arsenal. That it's too expensive and it's too risky. That the Soviets have an enormous backlog of consumer needs that they want to get to. that they have a capital shortage, unlike the U.S. where there's a capital surplus, that they have a labor shortage, unlike the U.S. where there's 20 million people who are unemployed during the course of any one year, that they have a building of their economy that they want, and that they have no design for nuclear superiority to control the third world, which is what the Reaganite grand design. And once that's revealed, once you see a Gorbachev with his wife who give all the evidence of being normal human beings rather than the demons that is being portrayed, and once you see him get up and say, we'll put it all on the table, all our missiles, 50% cut, stage one, the elimination of all intermediate missiles, stage two, the elimination of all tactical nuclear weapons, stage three, we'll eliminate it all, we'll get rid of them all by the year 2000. If we're bluffing, why don't you call our bluff? That becomes a very uncomfortable thing for Reagan, but he's been pushed into that. And what happens is it's demobilized that whole confrontation, Cold War mentality that he tries to build up so that he can get another $1 trillion from the American people for Star Wars, so they can keep building up those, that defense budget, so that he can keep intervening in this country or that country and keep making the world safe for multinational corporations. So he has that kind of problem of how to deal with the democratic forces in society, how to give the appearance of serving the people while serving the interests of his class, his global imperialist interests. Take the case of South Africa. It's a perfect example again. Ronald Reagan loves Botha. He loves the South African regime. He thinks it's okay. He's never had a harsh word to say about South Africa. He has never uttered a critical word. To the extent that he has uttered a critical word about any political force in South Africa, it was against the African National Congress and Nelson Mandela and Oliver Tambo, and said, well, they may have communists behind them. And no one's ever asked, what is it about a communist that's so bad? What is it about communists in El Salvador? Someone got up once and said, the Salvadorans aren't communists, they're just ordinary poor peasants fighting a revolution for a better deal for their country. The implication was, if they were communists, well, then it'd be okay to go in there and hammer them into dust. As a matter of fact, there are a number of those people in the FMLN who would not deny the label of communist, who would proudly say, yo soy un comunista, si. And they would tell you what they mean by it. They would mean clean drinking water for their people, and land reform, and literacy examinations, and literacy campaigns, and health clinics. That's what they're building, and that's the danger. Well, Reagan, in all these years in office, has not had a single harsh word to say about South Africa. But there are the democratic forces all over the world talking about South Africa, and the pressure is building up in Congress for sanctions against South Africa. So he puts up his own sanctions. And by the way, his sanctions were very close to the congressional sanctions. They're very real and very good sanctions. I looked at both accounts. The only joker is that there was no enforcement clause in his, as there was in Congress. That's the only joke. But now he turns to Botha, and Prime Minister Botha is miffed about this whole thing. What are you doing, Ronnie? And Ronnie says, Botha, baby, you know this is for appearance's sake. You know I love you. And Botha says, love, shmov, what are you doing? He said, this is only for appearances. And Botha reminds him, but appearances are an important part of politics. There are times when form is essence, you see. And the fact of the matter is that if the United States gives the appearance of abandoning this regime in South Africa, that pulls the rug out. And you can hear people who come back who say this, Afrikaners say, we got nothing to worry about because the United States is backing us. And as long as we got that kind of power and those funds and those multinationals and those markets and all that stuff, we got nothing to worry about. And when the President of the United States gets up and says, sanctions against South Africa, then you know that that's a real problem. Because the thing that South Africa wants now is someone to get up and say a good word about them. So, ladies and gentlemen, what I'm saying is, here you have a racist president. Here you have a reactionary president, an imperialist president, who has to take sanctions against South Africa. That's power. He's doing something that catches him up here. He doesn't want to do that. He's doing that because we have power. and we work and we percolate in communities all over this country, and that power percolates up, and it registers, and it registers in Congress, and it registers elsewhere, and it registers when cabinet members and assistant secretaries go places, and they hear this, and they see that, and they read this in the paper, and they see shanty towns put up and broken down and whatever else, and students getting arrested all over the place. There's a powerful movement that's been going on, and they have to respond to that. And they remember also the 60s. So you're building on the power of before. The fact that you might not remember the 60s doesn't mean that it isn't still part of what you're doing. And that's why we love you so much. I'm going to stop right there.